Hi, this is Kirsty Allsop.
And I'm Dr. Sam Godfrey. This is Stand Up to Cancer, the podcast. One in two of us will be diagnosed with cancer. And that's why it's important that we all understand the science of cancer. As they say of all great battles, you must know your enemy before you defeat them. And that's the aim of this series, to arm and educate us all about the realities of living with and fighting cancer. In today's episode, we're tackling taboo cancers.
So I'm Steve Nicholson and I'm a cancer doctor.
But not just any cancer doctor.
Well, I treat all sorts of cancers.
Could you be more specific?
Well, I specialise in cancer of the penis. And that usually is where the conversation stops.
Luckily, our conversation didn't. On today's Stand Up to Cancer podcast episode, taboo cancers. When we talk about cancer, it's often the more well-known breast, bowel, lung that we think of. It's less likely that you'll hear anyone mention something that's happening below the belt. That's why, in this episode, we're looking at lesser-known cancers, like those found in the penis or anus, to tackle taboo and empower everyone to feel they can take their worries to the GP.
To be honest, I don't think I've ever met someone with penis cancer.
Well, I think firstly, you know, if you did meet somebody, it's probably not something they're going to declare in the first 5 minutes of the conversation.
A few hundred men are diagnosed with penis cancer in the UK each year. Now, that might sound like a lot, but if you compare that to the total number of UK cancer diagnoses in 2013, say, where altogether there were 350,000 people diagnosed with cancer, it's just a drop in the ocean.
Well, it's not really surprising, I suppose, given how rare they are. People are going to be talking. We all know someone who's got lung cancer. We all know someone who's got breast cancer or bowel cancer. But as you say, neither of us actually necessarily know someone who's got penis cancer.
So these people sort of get left behind a little bit, would you say?
Well, I feel that, but then I would, wouldn't I? Because it's one of my interests. But I do feel that, you know, and I say this a lot, but it may be rare, but it's just as fatal. And in some ways, if we haven't developed the best approach to treating it, then the risks are greater than for some of the more common cancers.
How can we ensure that those rare cancers where, you know, you're not going to make a buck coming up with a miracle pill get the attention they need?
I mean, that's a really good question. I mean, because research is so expensive, you can see people absolutely pick their horse that's going to come in first. They're going to pick the one which is where there's a market. But we do need to change that. And actually, this is where things like charities come in. So Stand Up to Cancer fund translational research, and we don't have to please shareholders.
So Sam, is there any research on penis cancer happening?
Yeah, there is. So Stand Up to Cancer are funding, through Cancer Research UK, this trial that's actually going to try and nail down what's going on in penis cancer. What is the best treatment? We don't know. If researchers like Steve can establish that, then we've got somewhere to build from. That's the foundations upon which all progress can be made. So it'll probably be useful if we talk about what Steve Nicholson is doing in his Stand Up to Cancer clinical trial for penis cancer. And later on in the show, we're going to meet a man who has had penis cancer. Because a hugely important part of this trial is also asking, what type of surgery is best?
And the standard approach that we all agree on is that primary cancer in the penis needs to be removed.
I suppose if you cut it out, if you get all of it, it can't come back. Is that the thinking?
Well, the trouble is it can come back.
Oh, okay.
That's because the problem with cancer is it's not what you can see, it's what you can't see. It's the microscopic amounts that might already have spread even at the time that you've removed it.
And that's important because cancer cells in penis cancer, like many other cancers, do spread. And 9 out of 10 cancer deaths are due to the spread of cancer.
When you get, you got your sore throat, as a kid, your mother feels your neck, oh yeah, your glands are up. Yeah. Those glands are lymph nodes and you have them absolutely everywhere. And when a cancer spreads, it will usually spread first to the nearest group of glands.
And I guess once it's there, it's kind of tapped into this major transport system around the body. It can...
Absolutely.
This is why, if you think something's wrong, you've got to go to your GP. Because, I mean, that's very succinct when you hear that. You realise that our body does have this extraordinary transportation system where if something's wrong in one bit of us, it can ensure that it goes wrong in all of us if we leave it alone.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That's, I suppose I kind of think of it like if you had someone robbed a bank. If you can close the roadblocks nice and early, then the criminals can't get away. No. Whereas if you give them time before the police respond, the criminals are going to get far, far afield. Because these cancer cells, they do kind of burrow and move and swim effectively.
You know, when you give chemotherapy to somebody whose cancer hasn't spread to other organs, if you do that and they live longer, it's because somehow you've had an effect on the microscopic cancer that's either has spread or could spread around them. The bigger goal here is not just about what's going on in the groin. It's about what's going on elsewhere in the body.
So it wouldn't be surprising if men got a bit fixated on their groins.
I think as this is my first sort of media debut, I'm going to say no comment around that. But yeah, so the trouble with doing research on rare cancers is it's getting the numbers for the clinical trials. You need a lot of people in order to be able to prove that something works better, something works less well. So the more cases you have to compare, the more you can sort of really delve in and really be certain of your findings.
We're looking to recruit, over the period of this trial, we're looking to recruit 400 patients, which for such a rare disease is, you know, people think I'm barking mad when I say that. You know, when we start talking about those numbers, you kind of think, well, how is that achievable? And how are we going to get meaningful information out of that?
Because if you're going to find anything, you need to know it's going to be useful.
Basically, it's, in statistical jargon, it's called probabilistic. What's the probability of answer A being true? And it's kind of the way we use statistics in everyday life, although we're not thinking about it. You know, as you do every task in everyday life, if that task, if the way you've done it, if it works out, that reinforces your belief that you did it the right way. If you're driving to work and you take one road and you get to work 5 minutes earlier than you normally would, you think, oh, that's the best route. And if you try it again the following day and again you get to work early, then you believe it even more. And the more times you do it, it reinforces your belief that that's the right way.
Kind of like how ants, they sort of explore an area and if they find something positive, they leave a scent mark. And you get this build-up of sort of scent marks and then in it, what's the word, flock? I'm going to have to say this all again, I've gone nonsense. A flock of ants would be just being sheared by a miniature shepherd.
Okay, so now I've rather shamefully had to Google what a group of ants is called. Let's give that another go. So basically, the trial allows for testing a whole range of different models and factors, whereas normally you'd only test one on everyone. And in rare cancer, because there's so few people and there's so little known about them, speed's even more important. And that's where the probabilistic statistical factors come in.
That is one of the biggest tongue twisters I've ever heard. Anyway, go on, what were you saying?
So in short, if it worked last time, try it again. And each time it does work, then statistically it becomes more probable that it's going to help again.
So if you want someone to load the dishwasher, ask them to do it again and again and again, and eventually they might get it right.
Like Pavlovian conditioning. Maybe you give them a little reward each time.
And you know, this is trial design for the 21st century. And I think that other cancers, particularly rare cancers, but also the more common cancers, will start to look beyond the horizon and look at different trial designs. And I think it will produce results which are probably more applicable to everyday management of patients with a whole range of cancers.
I've got to ask, is it common for people with penis cancer to have their penis removed?
Well, I mean, it's a good question. It's a big concern for a lot of people, I'd imagine. The pathway of most...
I'd imagine too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a huge part of who you are. Huge, perhaps, good choice of the word there. The pathway of most penis cancers is surgery to remove the cancer, but that doesn't necessarily mean removing the whole penis.
This is Neil, who has had penis cancer.
And for someone in his 50s, he's pretty young to be diagnosed with it.
Because it was just a rash on the helmet of the penis, there was no soreness, there was no pain. When I was referred to the hospital, I still thought it was some form of irritation, skin rash, but when I saw the consultant up at Southmead Hospital in Bristol, he had a look and then sat me down and immediately told me that I had penile cancer. It was shock, really. I think the initial feeling was total shock. I think a lot of what the consultant said after that really went, it washed over me, really, because I was still thinking of the words cancer in my mind. And we literally stood up and he said, right, come with me. And within minutes, we were then at the theatre assessment unit getting booked in for a pre-hospital, a pre-op assessment, which, you know, it was unbelievable. You know, I had no idea. Amanda, my partner, had texted me to say, you know, how are you? How did you get on? And I literally was being seen at this assessment unit and said, just text me and said, I've got cancer. She then messaged me to say she was going to make her way straight up to the hospital. And I said, no, you know, don't do that. Go home. I'll see you straight at home. And I then made my way back from the hospital. And I remember it being so sunny and just being in complete and utter numbness and shock. And I literally was sitting on the bus coming back and there was lots of noise around me. And I was thinking how odd it was that, you know, there was so much noise around me. It just seemed deafening. And it was all happening and life was going on around me. Yet all I could think was, I've just walked out being told, you know, I've got cancer.
From there, it all happened very quickly. Within the next 3 weeks, his cancer was being treated.
So I then went back about a week later and was told the operation basically would go that he would amputate as much of my penis as he needed to do to get to a clear margin, if that meant taking away the whole penis, then that's what he would do. And, you know, we had to be prepared for that. As it was, I actually went through the partial amputation and the reconstruction on the first surgery.
Over the coming weeks, his bandages were changed daily as they had to make sure the graft, the skin from his leg, was taking to his reconstructed penis.
And I have said this before. I remember being in the hospital when I first come around from that surgery and I looked down and I had this bandage on my penis. And I looked at it and thought, oh, that looks okay. You know, it's quite a big bandage. You know, I don't think, you know, he's obviously, it's not been very bad, because the bandage looked quite long. I remember when they took the bandage off, they just kept taking it off and taking it off. And it always reminded me of a scene out of The Invisible Man unwrapping himself, because the more they took off of the bandage, the lower it was getting, with no sign of my penis there. And then eventually, obviously, you know, they did come to, you know, to the penis and the reconstruction that he'd done.
Neil then faced more tests to see if the cancer had spread, and made the decision to hold off over Christmas to go in for the surgery to remove his lymph nodes. It's major surgery. It means you have no protection from the waist down. So a common injury like a cut could mean he'd be at high risk of infection.
So I think as a man at this point, I think it's quite important to clear up how this surgery actually affects the function of the penis.
Physically, it works perfectly. So physically, it wouldn't stop me doing anything that I didn't before, acting perfectly functionally as a man in every way. The only difference is it desensitizes it. So you haven't got the same feeling, if you like, but it still works. It still works in every way, but it is very difficult to look down, even to the point where if I go into a male toilet, I will find a cubicle rather than stand there because it will spray, because it's, you know, more difficult to control. And also, I would be very aware if anyone was looking at me, and I was never, ever like that, you know, before.
And for Neil, it is these psychological elements that are often overlooked.
I look in the mirror, even to this day, and I don't feel the same person pre the surgery. And certainly I look and think to myself and have regular conversations with Amanda about why I can't understand why she still finds me attractive, because it is literally that affected. You know, it is very emasculating. You do look in a mirror and do feel so inferior to what you did before.
Neil's honesty is amazing because these rare cancers don't get as much attention. And another one that gets lost in a similar way to penis cancer, when compared to, say, testicular cancer, is cancer of the anus.
My name is David Sebag Montefiore. I'm a professor of clinical oncology and health research at the University of Leeds.
So it's probably not completely unsurprising for you to learn that I've chatted about anal cancer over a cup of coffee before.
No, clearly that's the way this is going.
Anyway,
when people consider cancer affecting the bowel, I think they think of the bowel inside them. So anal cancer is a rare disease. It only affects about 1,000 patients per year in the UK. And when I talk about anal cancer, we really mean cancers that arise really in the lowest 5 to 6 centimetres of the bowel.
What I did learn was, with this type of cancer, quality of life is a really important driving factor when choosing the type of treatment you receive.
The time I was finishing my training, a clinical trial was being done that was looking at a rare cancer, anal cancer, and where treatment with both radiotherapy or radiotherapy and chemotherapy was being tested. And it became clear that this approach to treatment was offering quite a high chance of eradicating the cancer using radiotherapy and chemotherapy without the need for patients to have what at the time was the standard treatment of major surgery.
Surgery, which is, it can be invasive, it's life-changing, and it can even result in having a colostomy, which is this bag that's sort of stuck on your stomach and essentially becomes your replacement anus.
Where necessary, patients who need to have a colostomy, the majority of those patients can adapt to that, but if there is a choice or if there is a treatment that avoids the need for a colostomy, then there are major advantages from the patient perspective. So there are no nursing requirements, there are no appliance requirements, but in practice it can have a major effect on patients' quality of life, on their body image, on their relationships. So if it's absolutely necessary to actually successfully treat cancer, then the majority of patients will accept that. But if there's an opportunity to successfully treat the cancer and avoid the need for a colostomy, that, I think, to most patients would be a major improvement.
So, if not surgery, a lot of the treatment is actually by radiotherapy.
Everyone's heard of radiotherapy, but unless you've seen it in action, you don't necessarily know what it involves.
It's probably easiest described as an X-ray type of treatment. It's a much more sophisticated and higher energy X-ray than, say, that's used to take a conventional chest X-ray. The radiotherapy treatment machines are relatively large, but they don't touch patients. And the radiotherapy beam is always delivered from about 3 to 4 feet away from the patient.
And this is where the trial that David's working on gets really fascinating.
There is an approach which has got a really complicated name called intensity modulated radiotherapy.
Or IMRT for short.
An IMRT is a way of giving treatment that allows us to give different doses of radiotherapy to different parts of the patient's body at the same time. So the radiotherapy machine will tend to rotate around the patient, giving treatment over a minute or two. And during that time, the actual shape of the radiotherapy beam and the intensity of the radiotherapy beam will be constantly changing in three dimensions.
So that means that you can give higher doses to the cancer and lower to the surrounding area so the side effects are minimised?
Exactly. Imagine it as actors on a stage.
So you could think of the actual person on the stage effectively being a representation of the tumour, and you'd have a high-intensity spotlight on the actor.
Oh, Romeo. Romeo. Wherefore art thou Romeo?
And then surrounding the actor, there might be some other little smaller actors that actually could represent the seeds that we can't actually see. And you want those to have low-intensity lighting. And then there'll be bits around the stage where you don't want those actors to actually touch those areas at all. And then you can try and sculpt the actual spotlights away from the areas that you need to avoid.
What's in a name? That which we call a rose, by any other name, would smell as sweet. So Romeo would, were he not Romeo called...
That is amazing.
And that's all in 3D, so it's like a theatre where you can move your seat to have a view from anywhere, literally 360 degrees at any time.
So are people already benefiting from this?
So I think this trial is a really good example of personalising treatment. But in this case, we're actually personalising radiotherapy.
And that's why Cancer Research UK, through the Stand Up to Cancer campaign, are funding the team's clinical trials.
When you're dealing with a rare cancer such as this, it is quite challenging to do clinical trials and clinical research. And that means that actually there is a variation in the dose that people receive around the world today for this disease. And actually, if we can actually understand this in more detail, we can get that dosing right much more accurately. So I think we'll see that there are different sizes of steps taking place all the time, and that there are times where there's a big step in one cancer, there may be a smaller step in another cancer. So I think we will continue to see improvements. And I think this approach that we've been very fortunate to have the support of Cancer Research UK and Stand Up to Cancer will allow us to do three more studies. And because of our previous experience, I think we have a very high chance of being able to successfully conduct this project.
Next week on Stand Up to Cancer, the podcast,
Professor Tim Maughan opens up about his important work leading the world's most advanced bowel cancer trial.
Cancer Research UK have just done this analysis that over the last 30 years, survival rates for cancer have moved from 1 in 4 to 1 in 2 of patients are now living alive 10 years after their cancer diagnosis. That's a fantastic change, and I've seen those changes in my practice.
The rebellion is growing.
Every day, more people are signing up and pledging ludicrous acts of defiance. Fancy shaving yourself a killer mohawk or munching on a plate of chilies? Do it. As long as you raise money for life-saving translational research, you're one of us. Let's stand together as one and rise up against cancer.
To help fund the rebellion against cancer, text AUDIO to 70404 right now to give £5 plus one standard message rate. 16 plus only, and you must have the bill payer's permission. It closes on the 31st of March 2017. Full T's and C's are available at sutc.org.uk/terms. 100% of your donation will go to Cancer Research UK in support of the Stand Up to Cancer campaign. Stand Up to Cancer and the Stand Up to Cancer brand marks are registered trademarks or trademarks of the Entertainment Industry Foundation. Cancer Research UK is a registered charity in England and Wales, Scotland and the Isle of Man.
Stand Up to Cancer, the podcast, is an Audio Boom production produced by Karen Bevan and Jamie Wareham. Executive producers Dan Quick, Audio Boom's head of production David Marsland, and global head of content Ruth Fitzsimons.